Hi, folks. This is Arnie Hackett in Raleigh. Today we have Mr. Mike Fitzpatrick of the ComServer Design and Strategy Group. He deals in performance. He's going to take us through a presentation that talks about load balancing with the new multi-site workload Lifeline product. And with that, I'll let Mike take it away.
All right. Good morning. What we're going to talk about here is a new product that we GA'd in June. As most of you are aware, Communication Server currently has several load balancing technologies available. Most common one is Sysplex Distributor. We also have a ZOS Load Balancing Advisor product that we ship as well. Both of those really deal with load balancing within a Sysplex. What this new product does is take that a step further and actually load balances between Sysplexes. And we'll go through some of the details about the specific product. But before we do, I wanted to just go over what we're going to do today. The first topic is going to be, what do we have for current disaster recovery solutions? Because this new multi-site workload Lifeline product really fits in with this new disaster recovery solution. It's basically the next generation of GDPS, which is geographically dispersed parallel Sysplex. It's GDPS Active Active Site. That was also GA'd in June of this year. Then we'll get into a little bit more detail about what exactly is the multi-site workload Lifeline, what's its role in this GDPS Active Active Site solution. And then in the appendix, just for future reference, just some of the common configuration statements that you use to be able to use this workload Lifeline product. So we'll start off with current disaster recovery solutions. First of all, why do we need disaster recovery solution? Basically, our disaster recovery solution, basically customers, you know, deal with needing business continuity at all times. A lot of the causes of interruption, things like, you know, component failures, either software defects, hardware failures, even operator errors is considered a component failure. Data is recoverable in those cases, but you may have to wait until the component is restored. For example, if you have a power outage, you have to wait until the power is restored before you actually be able to access that data again. Other causes of business interruption, surprisingly enough, is planned maintenance. With 24/7, you know, being the norm nowadays, the window for doing planned maintenance has shrunk tremendously, so that taking an outage so that you can apply maintenance or migrate to a new release, those will affect your business. Other things, disaster can occur as well, flood, earthquake, anything that you're not expecting. That, in that case, you could lose your entire site, and typically the data would not be recoverable if it was just on that one site. So when we talk about business continuity and disaster recovery, there's really a couple of key components to it. One is called the RTO, or recovery time objective. This is basically, how long does it take for me to restore my business operations? So if I lose a site, how long will it take me to bring up another site and be able to be open for business again? The other key measurement is the recovery point objective. Basically, this is how much data loss can I afford? So ideally, you want to have as low to zero of data loss as you can. As we'll show in most solutions, basically with speed of light issues, et cetera, you're not going to be able to reach that when you start trying to recover data over larger distances. So what are customers doing today? Going from left to right, these are kind of like the different iterations of disaster recovery that IBM has provided over the years. The first one on the left is basically your parallel Sysplex. You have a Sysplex with all the LPARs and images and DASD subsystems all within a single building. You can recover from LPAR failures where workloads can just shift from one LPAR to the other. You can recover from any types of DASD failure because you typically will have hyperswap running where you mirror DASD so that if a DASD subsystem fails, you can automatically switch over to another DASD subsystem within the building. Now, in this case, since it's synchronous, we're doing hardware synchronous replication of the DASD, you have no data loss. So in that case, the RPO is zero. Recovery time objective, if you have, for example, Sysplex distributing the workload among the different LPARs, if a server goes down or an LPAR goes down within the Sysplex, Sysplex distributor will just redistribute the traffic over to another server instance running in that Sysplex. So in that case, you really don't have any downtime as well. So the recovery time objective is zero. One of the main drawbacks to this solution is if you have a power outage or a fire or some disaster in that building, you've lost your entire data center. So what the first release of GDPS probably about 12 years ago was PPRC or peer-to-peer remote copy. Essentially what we did is we took that parallel sysplex and now split it and put one half of the sysplex in one building and one half of the sysplex in another building, say 10 kilometers down the road. In that case, now we are still doing synchronous disk replication, so we have an RPO of zero. The recovery time objective is no longer zero, because typically what you have is you have your subsystems and applications running on one half of the sysplex in one of the sites, and only if that site goes down, then you restart the applications and the subsystems on the other site, swap all the DASD over to the other site, and that will take typically under an hour to basically be open for business again. But again, the key thing there is that this is synchronous data disk replication, so you do have zero data loss. But because it's synchronous, you are limited to how far apart those data centers can be. Speed of light issues make it impractical to have more than 20 to 40 kilometers apart, because then you're incurring latency for every transaction that writes to those DASD. So what the next generation of GDPS was called XRC, or Extended Remote Copy. There's also a kind of a new flavor of it called GM, or Global Mirror. What we have there is we still have disk-based replication, but now what we have is that we have a sysplex, a complete sysplex in one site, and another sysplex that is not active in another site. And the disk replication that is occurring is asynchronous in nature, because we are going longer distances, and in this case, unlimited distances. We have to do asynchronous disk replication. What that means is our recovery point objective is no longer zero, but it is in the order of seconds. However, because this other site is really not doing anything, it's down, your recovery time objective is a little longer, because if you suffer an outage in the first site, to recover over to the other site, you have to IPL the system, start all the subsystems, make sure all the data is current and residing over in the other site, as well as starting all the applications and then directing any type of networking traffic to direct the workload over to the other site. This typically can take up to about 4 hours, typically 1 to 4 hours it will take for this to happen. Final one on the far right is really kind of a combination of the middle two. You can have PPRC within a metropolitan area, so you can recover from site A to site B pretty quickly. If you have a complete metropolitan disaster, then you can switch over to the remote site and site C. So that's what we have today. And basically, I wanted to kind of show this chart just to kind of give you an idea of the cost of downtime is. Customers a lot of customers have implemented disaster recovery solutions, but what they really need is for certain applications, they really need to go to a continuous availability model, which is no downtime. Because even in a high availability model, assume that you're up for 99.9% of the time during the year, that translates to about 9 hours of downtime a year. But that 9 hours is, if you look at by the cost of industry, you're talking for financials, for example, you're talking over $8 million an hour every time you're down. So do the math. It's a lot of money to be lost just to be able to achieve high availability for some of these applications and workloads. So that's why customers have been coming forward to us asking for, can we have a continuous availability solution? So some of the customer requirements then is they really wanted to shift from this failover model, which GDPS today provides, to a nearly continuous availability model. So what they want is they want to have the unlimited distances between the sites, but now instead of having an RTO of up to 4 hours, they want a recovery time objective of near zero as well. Since the data resides on both sites, with existing GDPS solutions, you don't use that data on that site until you fail over to the site. What customers want is the ability to say, well, if the data is on that site, I would like to be able to access that data from that site as well. Same time, between both sites at the same time. They like to do this without any application changes. They do like a lot of customers that do use GDPS today. There's a lot of automated scripts and processes in place so that if a disaster gets detected, automatic scripts take over and will actually move in IPL systems and do all that automated for the customer, which they like, because then if they have a disaster during a time where they're off shift, for example, they can still be handled. The other thing they want to do is provide a little bit more granularity. Today, with all the disaster recovery solutions, it's an all or nothing. Once the whole entire site fails, at that point you move workloads. You would move all the workloads over to the other site. What they would like is if individual workloads that fail within a site have those individual workloads, even if the site remains up, but those workloads are down, have the workload get moved to the other site as well. A bit more granularity. So let's talk about GDPS active sites. This is, we GA'd in June. Essentially what this is at a very high level, we'll have two or more sites separated by unlimited distances. They run the same applications, they have the same data, and then there's a cross-site workload balancing component of it that will be able to provide continuous availability and disaster recovery. So it's a complete shift from the disaster recovery solutions to date, which are a failover model, to a near continuous availability model. So in this slide here, what you'll see is there's actually several components that make up this overall solution. There's replication, and today with the current disaster recovery solutions, we use all hardware-based replication. Or in order to be able to access the data simultaneously on both sites, you can no longer use hardware-based replication, but you have to use software-based replication. So we have an existing product that we've incorporated into this solution, InfoSphere Replication Server for ZOS. This is a DB2 QREP function that some of you are probably familiar with. We've also created a new replication product for IMS called InfoSphere IMS Replication for ZOS, and that is to be able to do software-based replication of IMS transactions to both sites. There's also a controller piece in the lower right-hand corner. This is contains the GDPS panels that, if people are familiar with GDPS, is basically a centralized point to basically monitor all the workloads, be able to move workloads from one site to the other, IPL systems within a site, do capacity on demand planning and implementation. There's also a monitoring function that is provided by the Tivoli Enterprise Portal. There's a lot of parts here, a lot of different components, and what this Tivoli Enterprise Portal does is gather all the different types of metrics and data provided by all these different components and basically puts them into a graphical view so you can see how the status of the workloads are, status of the routing for those workloads, how is the replication behaving for those workloads. There's a lot of data that is all presented and gathered by this Tivoli Enterprise Portal. Finally, there's this workload distributor component, and this is really what we'll be talking about today. And what that is it consists of software and hardware. The software is the IBM Multisite Workload Lifeline, which we'll be talking about, and there's a SASP-enabled switch or load balancer. SASP, we'll get into a little bit, but basically what that does is it allows communication server or the Multisite Workload Lifeline to provide more detailed routing recommendations to an external load balancer. Today, most load balancers, they either do, generic like IP spraying between different clusters of servers, or they may actually have a little bit more intelligence where they may do go to one server and only if that's down they'll go to another server. But in terms of the capacity of, how much capacity on the systems where those applications are running or whether the application is really healthy, it's not really something that load balancers can do today. So with this Multisite Workload Lifeline product, we'll actually provide recommendations based on the capacity of the LPARs as well as the health and availability of the servers so that the workload distributor component, which includes that SASP-enabled load balancer, will make a better routing decision for workloads. So going to the next slide, there's a couple of configurations that we have announced in June. The first one is an active standby configuration, and we'll go over that in a subsequent slide. This has been generally available since June 30th. We also had a statement of direction about an active query configuration, which we'll talk about as well. The configuration is specified on a workload basis. So the way this will work is that if you have certain applications or workloads that require continuous availability, you would define them in this active configuration. If there's other workloads you have that do not have continuous availability requirements, you could continue to use the existing disaster recovery solutions that you employ today for those. This is really keyed for those specific workloads and applications you require continuous availability for. So what is a workload? It's really the software, and that is the applications and the middleware runtime environment that is needed for that workload. It's also the data. This is basically the set of data objects. For example, it may be an IMS database. It may be a DB-specific DB2 table within a DB2 database. And it's a network connectivity. Basically, how do you get to those applications using an IP address and port? Those three things together make up a workload. Now, going through the announced configurations, the first one is an active standby configuration. There's some automation here, so it may not show up well here, but essentially what I'm going to do is I have a single workload called workload A. In an active standby configuration, a given workload is active on one site and one site only, and it's in a mode called standby on the other site. And what that means then is as transactions flow into the workload distributor, it will route them to site one because that's where the workload is active. What will happen is replication that is running, software-based replication that is running in site one, will take those transactions, those updates that occurred in DB2 or IMS, and send them over to site two where they get replayed in site two. So at that point then, site one and site two, the data for this workload is nearly in sync. It's not exactly in sync because there is some network delay in getting that data across, but they're nearly in sync. Now, suppose either the site went down, site one went down, or even the site remained up, but workload A went down. The workload distributor component will understand or recognize that either the site went down or the workload failed, and immediately it will then say any new transactions or connections for this workload, I'm going to send to site two because now site two is my active workload. Remember, we had done software-based replication, so the data over on site two has been updated as transactions were getting sent over to site one. So at this point, any transactions that occur now or connections coming in, workload distributor will now send them to site two. This switchover is pretty much instantaneous. Once we detect a workload failure or a site failure, we'll immediately switch over. There's no starting of IPLing of systems or subsystems or IP or starting applications in site two, because everything is up and running at this point. What you'll also notice, though, is replication is running there as well. But what it will do, since site one is down, what it does now is it basically queues any of those updates that it captured. And instead of sending them directly over to site one, it queues them until site one comes back up. Once site one comes back up, those queued replication requests will get sent over to site one, and that will actually bring site one back into sync as well. Of course, if site one is down for days and days, there's only so much amount of memory we can queue stuff up. So we will eventually stop trying to queue things if site one is down for an extended period of time, in which case what you would need to do is take a snapshot of your database and reload it in site one to basically get it up to speed again. One thing I want to talk about with the active standby configuration is not all workloads have to go to the same site. So in this example here, suppose I have two workloads. I have application A is active, and that is on site one, and it's in standby mode in site two. So any transactions for the workload A will go to site one and get replicated over to site two. Now, suppose I also have a workload B. In this case, I can make workload B be active in site two and standby in site one. The key thing, again, about workloads, remember I said what the definitions were. One of the things it has to have is unique data sources. So, for example, if workload A was a DB2 workload, access data, and workload B access IMS data, they can be considered different workloads. However, if application A was accessing a specific DB2 table and application B was accessing that same specific DB2 table, they can't be in separate workloads. They have to be in the same workload at that point because that's basically the requirement. Otherwise, what would happen is if we were to allow different applications that access the same data to go to different sites, you would get basically out-of-sync data and replication conflicts. So at this point, with an active standby configuration, what we do is we basically ensure you'll never get data conflicts because any workloads or applications that access a certain pieces of data, if they access the same data, they've got to be defined in the same workload, which means the workload distributor will only send them to one site at a time. All right, so in this case here, because I have workload B active on site 2, any connections go to site 2, and the data that's any updates to the databases get replicated over to site 1. Now, the key thing with this configuration is either site can basically take over for each other. So if application A were to fail on site 1, well, site 2 would now basically handle application A and application B's workload. So it's basically each one is recovering for each other in this scenario. But in this case as well, now that you have the two data centers, as you can see, you can use both data centers at the same time now, as long as you make sure that you define the workload so that they're not sharing the same data. Okay, the next one is active query configuration. This is the one that we've done a statement of direction for. Essentially, what we have here is we have an active standby workload. In this case, we have application A, which is in its own workload, and it is active on site 1 and standby in site 2. So again, any connections that go in get distributed over to site 1 and then replicated over to site 2. But now I can suppose I have another application that accesses the same data, but all it does for that data is just query the data. It never does any updates for the data, so it's purely a query workload. So in that case, it's related to application A's data because it's using application's same data that application A is using. However, it is not updating it. So in that case, what we can do for application B is a workload distributor now can send these query requests to either site because the data is available on either site. So as you'll see, basically the workload distributor can send some of their query requests to site 2, and it can send some to site 1. Now, in addition to that, there is an additional intelligence built into this workload distributor because based on how behind site 2 is, so we're doing software-based replication, which is asynchronous in nature. For example, site 2, the data on site 2 might be 2 seconds behind site 1. If that's within your policy that says that's okay to have data up to 2 seconds old, the workload distributor will continue to route traffic query workloads to both sites. But now suppose the latency between the two sites is 5 seconds. So now the data on site 2 is 5 seconds behind site 1. That may be outside of your policy, and you may say you can't tolerate having data staler than 2 seconds. In that case, the workload distributor will know that the data is 5 seconds behind on site 2. So for the query application B workload, he would send all of it to site 1 where the data is more current. And as the latency falls back down, the workload distributor reacts to it and then distributes to both sites again. So there's additional built-in intelligence in the workload distributor in the active query configuration to determine whether, you know, how much tolerance for stale data the application can handle. All right, just a quick thing. We've done some preliminary testing on the active standby just to give you an idea, because one of the goals here was to be able to have unlimited distance, but instead of having that recovery time objective of up to 4 hours, to basically have it within seconds. So what we've done is there's 4 different scenarios we did. One of the ones is a planned workload switch. And what's nice about this solution is as I mentioned, one of the issues with business continuity is to basically have planned outages for updating or applying maintenance, for example. So what you could do with active standby now is you could have a workload active on one site. You could bring that workload down on site 1 and move it over to site 2 so that you could apply maintenance for that workload on site 1 with no disruption for the workload, because now the workload is being serviced by site 2. So in that case here, in that scenario where we had a planned workload switch, we were able to move that workload from one site to the other and have the applications continue to be able to, or clients continue to be able to use that workload, and it took only 20 seconds to do that. So basically you had a downtime of 20 seconds while we moved a workload from one site to the other. In the case of an unplanned workload switch, in this case it's basically if, for example, all the server's applications for that workload were to go down on one site, the multi-site workload lifeline actually has built-in detection to determine when all the application for a workload go down. And at that point, it will actually trigger a switch over of the workload to the standby site. In our scenario here, it took us 120 seconds to do that. The key thing here, though, is we actually, there's a piece of policy called a workload failure detection interval. Essentially, what that says is instead of immediately reacting to a workload failure, continue to pull for a certain amount of interval to make sure that workload is really down. And in this case here, our workload failure detection interval was 60 seconds. After 60 seconds of understanding that the workload was down, we initiated a switch, and it took less than 2 minutes to do this operation. The key thing with both of these, the planned and unplanned workload switch, existing GDPS disk-based replication solutions, it's not possible because there's no understanding of workload granularity. It's all at a site level. But now the other two things we did were the planned site switch, and in this case, for example, suppose we wanted to bring the entire site down for a power on resets or whatever for whatever reason. In that scenario, we actually had 10 workloads running on one site, and it took us about 20 seconds to move all 10 workloads over to the other site. And current GDPS disk-based replication, that's at least 1 to 2 hour operation to do that. So, again, we were able to have the unlimited distance, and we were able to bring our RTO, or recovery time objective, down to within seconds. And the final one is the unplanned site switch. In this scenario here, similar to the unplanned workload switch, you do have a failure detection interval, and in our case, it was, again, 60 seconds. And what we were able to do is detect that the site failed and move all 10 workloads over to the other site in about 150 seconds. We are actually making some optimization to this where we've actually shaved another 40 seconds off this, so it has takes us under 2 minutes now to move 10 workloads in an unplanned site outage from one site to the other. So again, very low RTOs, which is really what their customer requirements were. Okay, that is basically talking about existing solutions and the whole overall GDPS active sites. Are there any questions on that before I jump into the specifics of the workload lifeline? Okay, just a quick foil on obviously the benefits of intelligent load balancing. With load balancing, you get improved performance. What happens is whatever this piece of hardware or software that does load balancing, if he knows how healthy the server applications are or how healthy the systems where they're running are or how much capacity on those systems are, it is able to do better. You're able to get better response time for your transactions because we will balance the connections to the server applications that are best able to handle this work. In terms of availability, it also improves things because if you have more than one server instance up that you're load balancing to, if a single server instance goes down, not a big deal. We'll just switch over and load balance to whatever remaining server instances are around. And in terms of scalability, again, one of the benefits of load balancing is as suppose you have four server applications, and during peak times you may need to bring on a fifth instance on a different LPAR. You can bring that on. The load balancing component will be able to detect a new server instance available and now route transactions to that one as well. So for GDPS active sites, basically they looked at what they needed for load balancing requirements. So as I mentioned, our existing ones today, everything focuses on a Sysplex. We can route with Sysplex Distributor or ZOS Load Balancing Advisor within a Sysplex scope. With GDPS active, we need the ability to distribute workloads between the sites and route around the failed sites. And this is based on the capacity and health of the sites and the health of the server application instances within that site. The other key point to mention here is that for existing load balancing Sysplex Distributor and ZOS Load Balancing Advisor, what they do is they load balance a group of same application servers. For example, if you have four KIX regions all running the same, on the same port, what Sysplex Distributor can do is route those four between those four KIX regions. Now, suppose the KIX regions are accessing a DB2 database on the back end, and you also have a DB2 Connect workload accessing that same data. Sysplex Distributor and ZOS Load Balancing Advisor don't have a concept to know that those two types of server applications are related in the sense that they access the same data. So what we need the ability for active sites is the ability to group those two different types of server applications and call them the same workload because they're accessing the same data. And so any routing decisions we make are based on the applications for both of those, or the two different types of applications for that workload. The other thing that we need the ability to do is to detect the workload failures as well as site failures. The ability to switch workloads from one site to another site. This is a graceful takeover that I had mentioned before when you need to do any type of site maintenance or workload plan maintenance for a workload. What we also want to have the ability to do is, because this is a continuous availability solution, you do not want to have any single points of failure. So we have a component, which we'll talk about in a little bit, that is responsible for telling the load balancer how to direct workload to which sites. We need another instance of that basically stays around and detects if the primary workload manager is to go down, this secondary or peer workload manager comes up and takes over as if nothing has changed. We also need the ability to dynamically add and modify workloads on the fly. You don't want to bring down a lot of infrastructure in order to configure new workloads. So we need the ability to add workloads or change the characteristics of a workload on the fly and have them take effect immediately. The other thing is there's a lot of routing recommendations, and we'll show you how all of those are gathered. So what we do is we actually surface all those to network management agents. And, for example, the Tivoli Enterprise Portal has NetView agents that retrieve this information on its behalf. So those are some of the requirements we have. This is a high-level overview of the workload lifeline structure. Essentially, what you have here is you have two sites, and you have a bank of first-tier load balancers outside of the sites. Those first-tier load balancers, what they're responsible for is for a given workload in an active standby configuration, they are going to route to either site one or site two. And when they route to within those sites, what they're going that first-tier load balancer bank is going to do is actually route to a set of second-tier load balancers within a site. Those second-tier load balancers most likely will be Sysplex distributor, in which case then what it does is once within the site, it will choose which server applications is best able to handle the workload, which is similar to what exists today. The key point is that first-tier load balancer, its job now is to determine for a given workload where to route it to, what site to route it to. So we also have in each site, we have this concept of a controller. This is taken from the existing GDPS disaster recovery solutions. What this controller is, it's a standalone LPAR, and we have a product, or we have a component of the workload lifeline on it called the Lifeline Advisor. That Lifeline Advisor runs on that controller, and its job is to basically do a few set of things. It communicates, as in this picture, in this first picture here, it communicates with the Lifeline agents. What the Lifeline agents, they run on every LPAR within each of the sites. Those Lifeline agents, what they're responsible for is they monitor the health of the server applications for every workload it needs to monitor, as well as the capacity of the LPARs on those where those server applications are running. And it reports all that information into the Lifeline Advisor. There is also the Lifeline Advisor takes all that information as well as the information about you define where you want that workload to be active, either on site one or site two. The Lifeline Advisor then communicates with the first-tier load balancers through this SASP protocol that I mentioned a little bit earlier, and we'll go into a little bit more detail. And what it does then is it tells those first-tier load balancers, for this type of workload, I want you to either send it to site one or site two. Now, the second-tier load balancers I mentioned most likely will be Sysplex distributor. It could also be a external load balancer that supports SASP communication as well. And in that case, the Lifeline Advisor will tell those second-tier load balancers within that site or within that Sysplex how to route the work between the different server applications that make up that workload. There's also advisor-to-advisor communication. So, again, to avoid single points of failure, you have a primary controller and you have a secondary controller. If the Lifeline Advisor on the primary controller were to go down, or the primary controller itself were to go down, the Lifeline Advisor that is running on the secondary controller would detect that, and it would actually take over and become the primary Lifeline Advisor. At that point, what would happen is all of the Lifeline agents and the load balancers would connect into that new Lifeline Advisor instance down in the secondary controller. And from a end user perspective, it looks like nothing has changed. First-tier load balancer is communicating with an advisor, and all the agents are communicating with advisor. So again, that's just to avoid single points of failure. The other piece of communication that occurs is the Lifeline Advisor talks with the support element, or SE, in each of these in each of the techs that make up the site. What the support element is, for those familiar with HMC or the Hardware Management Console, from a Hardware Management Console, you can go and you can view statuses of LPARs, you can IPL LPARs, you can quiesce LPARs, you can bring on CPs, off, you know, a lot of different things from the Hardware Management Console. The way it does it is it communicates directly with the support element that within each mainframe, it can monitor all the LPARs and all the and other information within that tech. So what the Lifeline Advisor does, it is actually communicates with that support element, because it will know, based on when the Lifeline agents connect into the advisor, it will know what LPAR image each of these agents is running on. So the Lifeline Advisor then communicates with the support element to say, tell me the health of that, tell me the status of that LPAR. So for a given site, if every LPAR, if the, the support element reports that every LPAR is down for that site, then from a Lifeline Advisor perspective, it would say, hey, that's a site failure. So that's how it detects site failures, by basically by basically communicating with the support element, and the support element tells them the status of the LPARs that make up that site. Now, the final communication that occurs is there's a NetView instance that is also running on the primary controller. The Lifeline Advisor feeds information to him, for example, basically telling him all the server applications that make up a workload, how healthy and what are the availability of those server applications for those workloads. What is the status of the workload? Is a workload active on site one or site two, or is it active on either site? So that kind of information gets pushed back to NetView, and then NetView communicates that to Tivoli Enterprise Portal, where it basically graphically displays all this information. So going then kind of through, again, some of the roles in an active standby environment that the Workload Lifeline supports, it provides distribution recommendations to multiple tiers of load balancers. It uses server-specific WLM metrics and communication server weights, and I'll get to into that on a little bit on the next slide, exactly what those are. But basically, all the agents running and all the LPARs across both sites send all this information to the Lifeline Advisor. So then the advisor uses that to build recommendations. With a first-tier load balancer, he creates site recommendations. So what he does is he'll tell the first-tier load balancer for a given workload how to which site to route it to. And it's based upon a couple of things. Well, the first thing it's based on is where the workload is currently active. If the workload is active on site one, the advisor tells those first-tier load balancers, send all connections for this workload to site one. If, for example, the workload were to fail on site one, well, the advisor will know that all the work that all the servers that make up that workload have failed. He'll tell the first-tier load balancers now, okay, stop sending it to site one, send all these new workload new connection requests for this workload to site two. That's how we're able to quickly move from one site to the other for a given workload. Okay. So that's so the advisor does provides those site recommendations to the first-tier load balancer. It also now provides specific server application recommendations to second-tier load balancer, because the job of the first-tier is to send it to a specific second-tier load balancer. Once it's within that site, those second-tier load balancers for that workload will know, have a set of server applications within that Sysplex that he can route to. And based on recommendations from the advisor, if this second-tier load balancer really is an external load balancer, he'll get those recommendations and then know which server instances, how to route work between the server instances. If Sysplex distributor is the second-tier load balancer, the advisor does not provide him any recommendations, because the Sysplex distributor learns those server application recommendations on his own. It's just if the second tier happens to be another SASP-enabled load balancer, would the advisor provide recommendations to him as well? Okay, we talked about, you know, what are the weights that the agents provide on a server application instance. It provides several things. One of them is a WLM weight, specifically the server-specific WLM recommendation. This is really says not it's not a metric of how much capacity is left on the LPAR. It's really how much capacity is left on the LPAR relative to applications that are on a lower that have a lower importance level. So, for example, if we have a capacity, if the LPAR is at 100% capacity, but this server is running at a higher level than 20% of the workload, well, we really have 20% available capacity on this LPAR to handle this work. So that's what server-specific WLM recommendations give you, is a little bit more granular metric based on the importance level of the specific applications making up the workload. The other thing that the agents provide is something called a communication server way. This is really based on how healthy are the servers. So we do kind of proactive things so that if we see that the server application is running, but its backlog of connections is getting larger and larger, meaning it can't keep up with the new connection rate, we'll treat that as saying, well, that server application, even though he's available, he's kind of unhealthy, and maybe we'll stop recommending him. We'll lower our recommendation of it. Similarly, if you see that the server application is just not accepting any new connections at all. All new connections are getting dropped. Again, that tells us that server application, even though he's available, he may not be completely healthy, and we may try to avoid him as well. So the advisor uses these relative weights within a site to determine whether a workload failure has occurred. So, for example, if the agent report back that there is no server application for this workload, if all agents report back that there's no server application for a given workload, we'll declare that as a workload failure. Likewise, if the agents report back that all the servers are available, but all of them are completely unhealthy, for example, they're all stalled, that again tells us as a workload failure, and we can treat that as a workload failure and move the workload to the other site. All right, some other things that a Lifeline advisor does in an active standby environment. I had mentioned this previously. The existing load balancing technologies always kind of treat a group of servers that are the same servers listening on a specific port and routes traffic between those server instances. What we needed with the advisor is the ability to have different types of server applications that might access the same data. They need to be defined into the same workload. So what we'll do then is we'll group those different server applications into a workload, and we distinguish different workloads so we can have different distribution decisions based for each workload. So one workload can be active on site one, one workload could be active on site two. And we'll continue to monitor that and make decisions based on that, but we will have the ability to route workloads differently. The other thing the advisor is responsible for is detecting for the workload failures that I had mentioned already, basically the capacity of the LPARs and the health of the server applications. The other thing it's responsible for is detecting site failures. This is where I talked about where we communicate with over an HMC network, similar to how the hardware management console does, basically to verify the LPAR status. So if we determine that all the LPARs are not active on that site, then we can determine if we have a site failure, and we can dynamically switch all the workloads that we knew at the time were active on that site. We can move it over to the alternate site. Okay, so some of the communications we talked about a little bit is the advisor communicates with a peer advisor, and the reason for that is that we don't want a single point of failure. So the primary advisor, he gives all the workload state information about whether it's inactive or if it's active, which site is it active to. And the peer advisor is responsible for monitoring the primary advisor. So if the primary advisor goes down for any reason, the peer advisor will automatically determine that and take over responsibility. So he'll become the primary advisor, essentially, so that you don't have a single point of failure, and now all the load balancers communicate with this new primary advisor. The other thing is, which is a very key thing, and we've talked about it a couple times, is really how the advisor, he can provide a graceful movement of the workload. And this is what I talked about a little, Peter, with you, how we do this. We basically quiesce the workload, and that prevents any new connections for the workload being distributed to the active site. We then will terminate any existing connections still being distributed to that active site. And then after that, both of those steps are done, we can now reroute new transactions or connections to the alternate site, which means we've guaranteed that there's no workload, that there's no connections for that workload running on the other site. The other thing we have is that if you want to add or change the behavior of existing workloads, you can do that on the fly by just dynamically refreshing the configuration, we call it. So that allows you to do it without recycling the advisor, because recycling the advisor potentially is an outage. So we want to try to avoid outages at all costs if possible. The other thing is we have a new network management interface. It's a documented interface that surfaces, you know, workload states, the distribution recommendations for each of the workloads, and specific component information. What that means is things like the health of the server applications as well as the capacity of the LPARs. We surface all that up to network management agents. It's a documented interface. Today, currently, NetView is the only one that's retrieving this, but other ones will probably be doing it as time goes on. The final thing is, from the agent perspective, is because they're responsible for doing monitoring the capacity of the LPARs as well as monitoring the health of the applications, they communicate directly with the communication stack. There's documented interfaces that allows us to extract information about the available server applications and their health. And that's what the agents will do, directly communicating with the communication server stack and then giving those recommendations to the advisor. All right, we're going to quickly go over then some of this other pieces of information. I wanted to talk about some of the different types of communication. One of them is the advisor to the load balancer communication. This is, I had been talking about the SASP, Server Application State Protocol. It's an actual documented RFC. And basically what it does, it allows workload managers to give better distribution recommendation to load balancers. And this is what the Lifeline Advisor does. So what the first tier load balancer does is it registers the groups that he's interested in load balancing. So the groups really consist of second-tier load balancers because that's what the first-tier load balancer is responsible for. So it's a set of second-tier load balancers within each site. And basically what happens is the advisor verifies that the load balancer can connect to him. And then what he does is based on those groups that are registered by this first-tier load balancer, he uses another configuration statement, which is in the appendix, called the cross-dispatch list configuration statement. He maps these load balancing groups into workloads. So this is where we get the mapping of you could have multiple different types of server applications that all belong to the same workload. The advisor does that mapping on behalf based on what was registered by the first-tier load balancers. Similarly, if you have second-tier load balancers that are SASP-enabled, if you're not using Sysplex Distributor for your second tier, it also registers groups with the advisor, and it's basically the list of server applications and the ports on a specific system, on a specific site. And now load balancers, just a little bit of information. Load balancers, they receive distribution recommendations two different ways. They could either periodically pull the information from the advisor or the advisor periodically push recommendations. We only allow the configuration to be a push model. Basically, the reason behind that is if a workload fails, we want to immediately notify the load balancer. We don't want to wait for him to pull information, so the advisor will push that information immediately out to him. Now, advisor-to-agent communication, this is what I kind of talked about before as well, how the agents each connect to the advisor. Part of the information it sends to him is its system name, the Sysplex name, and the LPAR name. Why this is important is we need the LPAR information from an advisor perspective so he knows all the different LPARs that make up a site. So when he can then communicate with the support element, he can figure out which LPARs are active or not within that site. And so what happens is the advisor sends information when the load balancers register the different server load balancing groups. The advisor sends this information to each of the agents to monitor. So it will be a set of all the server applications. There may only be a subset running on that LPAR where the agent's running, but the agent automatically will learn about all the server application he needs to monitor. And the agent periodically sends updates to the advisor. So basically what he does is periodically he'll say, here's a list of server applications that are active on my system. What are the health of the applications? What is the WLM capacity? You know, or what is the capacity of the LPARs based on WLM? Passes that information periodically to the advisor. The advisor gets all that information to figure out how to load, whether workloads are active or not. The advisor, this is going back to how the advisor knows how to reset connections. Basically, there's a new command, a deactivate command from Lifeline Advisor. What that does is the advisor then can send a list of all the server applications that make up a workload to each of the agents and tells the agents reset any active connections for that workload or for those specific server applications. Advisor-to-advisor communication, this is an internal protocol. Basically, what happens is the secondary advisor connects to the primary advisor, and the primary advisor sends information about its configuration to the peer advisor. part of what you want to make sure is that both of these configurations are identical, because if the secondary advisor takes over, if it was misconfigured and had a completely different configuration, the state of all the workloads potentially could change. So what we do is when a peer advisor connects, we verify that the configurations are the same, and if not, we issue some warning message for you to be able to correct it. And the advisor then, any type of time a workload state changes, it sends that information to the peer advisor, because what will happen then is if the peer advisor becomes a primary advisor, he needs to know the state of all the workloads. The other thing we do is in order to communicate with the support element or SE, we use a documented IBM protocol called the BCPII or Base Control Program Internal Interface. What that does, it allows communication between the LPAR where the advisor is active and all CPCs that are available on that network. And so what we do is we contact each CPC and ask for a list of LPARs. We then know what LPARs we need to monitor, and we basically can tell us the CPC, give me the status of the specific LPAR. There's this BCPIP address space that actually was shipped in V1R11 as part of ZOS. The advisor uses this address space. It's basically, so the advisor doesn't communicate directly with the SC. It uses this new address space as a bridge to get to the SCs. Finally, there's a network advisor to network management application communication. This is our documented NMI, or network management interface. Essentially, the advisor creates an AF Unix socket and accepts connection from any type of network management applications, and it will supply information such as a workload state, information about the site, the LPARs that make up the site, all the server applications that are in a group, all the different agents and advisors that make, and any load balancers. So it gives a whole snapshot of everything about the state from an advisor perspective. There's a lot of commands that you can do directly from the advisor and agents to get even more information. So a lot of the information we provide to the NMI, for example, in this display advisor command, you can get that same information from this command here, and actually it will get displayed onto a console instead of through network management interface. You can display the current active configuration for your advisor. You can display information about all the load balancers that have connected to you. So part of that is basically all the different types of load balancers that are connected to you, whether they're a first-tier or second-tier load balancer, as well as all the different types of groups that are registered by those load balancers. There's also a display workload detail command. What that does is it displays the status of all the defined workloads that were defined to the advisor. What it includes is basically the status, whether it's active or not, what site it's active on, and the list of all the server applications that make up the workload and whether they're available or not. So it gives you quite a bit of information about a given workload. Some of the specific state chains, these are not displays, but these are actual state chains. The first one is an activate command. This is how you direct the first-tier load balancer to distribute new connections for a workload to a specific site. So you say, for a given workload, this is the site I want to activate it on. A workload, as I mentioned, for active standby can only be active on one site at a time. So if it's currently active and you need to move it to another site, you would go to this third command, which is a quiesce workload. What this does, it basically says, stop distributing new connections for this workload that is currently. So, for example, if it was active on site one, if I do a quiesce workload, it will now stop the load balancers from sending any new workload requests into site one. Then the next command you would do is this deactivate workload, which basically says any existing connections for that workload should get reset. And finally, you could do another activate command to the other site at that point. We also have a refresh command. What this does is this basically, if you have a misconfiguration between the two advisors and you want to update one of the advisors, or if you wanted to add a new workload on the fly to an existing advisor, you can update the configuration file and then do this refresh command, and the advisor automatically rereads the configuration file and then builds this new active configuration. There's also this takeover command. This is, again, you can, not only do you need to wait for a failure for a primary advisor in order to have the secondary advisor takes over, if you wanted for any reason to bring down the primary advisor for maintenance reasons, you can issue a takeover command from the secondary advisor, and what that will happen is it would basically then assume primary advisor responsibility and cause the old primary advisor to become a secondary advisor. at which point you could bring down the secondary and apply maintenance. So again, you can gracefully bring down components of this without affecting the, any of the workloads. Some key display commands for the agents. You can display its configuration as well. You can also, since the agent's responsible for monitoring a set of server applications, you can do this display members command, which will give you all the server applications this agent is currently monitoring and what the state of those server applications are. Some of the key state change commands. What you can do, again, to basically gracefully bring server applications in and out, if you have to bring a server application down for any reason, you can, for maintenance, for example, what you can do is you can issue this quiesce command, which basically says, "Don't allow. We're not going to advertise this server application as being available for any new connections." So that allows you to bring the server application down and then do apply maintenance and bring it back up, at which point you'd want to do an enable command, which basically says, okay, this application is available again to be load balanced to. These commands are only issued, are only valid if that second-tier load balancer is another external load balancer. If it's Sysplex distributor, you can do the same thing by doing the Sysplex quiesce and Sysplex resume commands. Finally, just debugging. We record a lot of information into syslog D. So there's a debug level statement that's both in the advisor and agent, and you can set it. By default, it's on. There's a whole different set of levels of tracing that we can support. The minimum level or the default level is basically any types of messages or errors or warnings that have occurred, and that's usually the default. If you need more information, you can dynamically change the debugging level on the fly, and then we would actually, for any types of failures or bugs, that we would actually request certain debug levels, and then you would send us the syslog results, and we'd be able to debug from there. We do not use ctrace at this point. For more information on the Lifeline product, here's the website for it. You can go out, and there's actually, from here, you can actually get, there's a configuration manual that's out there that gives a lot more information about the product, the commands, the configuration, if you're interested in it.
Thank you, Mike. That all conclude the session. Thank you.